Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. I'm very delighted indeed to be here today to come back to Abhayagiri Monastery. I was just recollecting the Katina Day 3 years ago, at the end of 2009. And when we were all gathered together, many of us were there on that day. And at that time, I had no clue that I would be soon moving house to go back to England. And I remember it was my turn to be the recipient of the Katina cloth that year. And because, as you see today, there are many different bolts of cloth that are given, and there are some thicker, some thinner, some that are of different qualities, different characteristics. And then when the monks said, well, which of these bolts of cloth would you like your robe to be made from? And I made a particular choice, and they said, after a little while, the monks came back to me and said, well, Ajahn, that's obviously 100% cotton, but it's a bit thick. Don't you think it'll be a bit hot in the summer? And I thought, well, it's a good enough. And so it turned out that it was absolutely the perfect thickness for an English summer. Little did I suspect that I was already choosing the appropriate cloth for the climate I was going to be spending my future summers in. So this year, 2012, this is only 16 years after Abhayagiri Monastery opened its doors, and I was just recollecting as I arrived here a couple of days ago and being taken around and visiting the new kutis. Since I left in July of 2012, 8 new kutis have been built and a whole new workshop. So the guys have been busy while I've been away. There are many flies here, but the Ajahn Pasano and the Sangha do not stay still long enough for the flies to rest upon them. So that it was really wonderful to see just in this short time the further developments that have happened, but also with the advantage of having been away for a couple of years or so and then coming back in as a visitor, then it's an ideal opportunity when you're not tied up with the whole flow of developments or different decision making or in the middle of certain projects. You can come in and appreciate the whole thing with a fresh eye. And it's been really striking to me how 16 years ago, June the 1st, 1996, a handful of us rolled up the drive here. Debbie Stamp, I think, was driving one of the vehicles. Anagarika Tom, who's now the well-established Ajahn Khrunadhammo, just finished his 15th reigns as a monk. He was a one-day-old Anagarika on the day that the monastery opened. He received the 8 precepts on the full moon day of May, May 31st, and we rolled up the drive on June the 1st, 1996. And just to walk through the forest and to see all of the different trails that have been made, the different kutis and dwellings, the wonderful Bhikkhu Commons utility building made up in the forest, and then down here, this wonderful complex of buildings down here, and also in particular, most importantly, seeing the very well-established, well-trained, and harmonious community of monks, novices, and anagarikas living here, and the concord between the monastic sangha and the lay community, seeing that kind of depth of well-being, of spiritual health in the community, and the richness of the Sangha life here has been extremely inspiring. Just to come back and to consider, just in 16 years from the the ragtag bunch of people that came up the drive, myself and Ajahn Visuddhi, one other monk, and then the Anagarika, who's now Ajahn Karunadhammo, and a group of lay people. What has happened in that last 16 years is quite wonderful and heartwarming, very moving to see how the whole place has developed and become a real treasure, a real jewel, and a facility, a community which is very much enabled to benefit the lives of everyone gathered here, and also many hundreds or thousands of other people, both in this country and around the world. I felt very many years ago when Lumpur Sumedho first invited me to look after the California project. I felt very honored and inspired, a little bit out of my depth, but you know, I was ready to jump in and risk it. And so seeing these developments all this time later, it's been very delightful and extremely gladdening. And also, you know, when Lumpur Pasano and myself, when we got word that I had received an invite to go to England to be the abbot of Amravati, both of us, our immediate feeling was, oh well, I was enjoying that. But after we had the Katina here in 2009, we both went off traveling to Southeast Asia. We were traveling in Thailand together with Rhoda, Ajahn Pasano's mother, and Debbie was also along with us. And it was during that time we were at some meetings at Wat Pa Nanachat in Northeast Thailand when Lumpur Sumedho popped the question and invited me to go back. And so both myself and Lumpur Pasano have had a very rich and delightful, harmonious relationship from the 14 years that we were leading this place together. And both of us had that immediate feeling of a sort of sadness and a sense of grief that our time together as a partnership of say collaborating to lead and develop this community together was over. But as we all know, all good things come to an end. You know, we all have to grow up, and now, you know, the kid's a teenager. Bayagiri is 16 years old. It's a very well-behaved 16-year-old, exemplary. And so that even though there was that feeling of sadness or loss that we were no longer going to be a team on a day-to-day basis, we very quickly realized, okay, well, we just have to build some more bridges between England and California. And so that I was very happy that Lumpur Pasano could come over last year and to be the presiding elder at the Amravati Katina, and to be the recipient of the royal Katina cloth there. And also I was very glad to have this opportunity to come back and be with so many dear and old friends here in Abayagiri once more. And I hope we'll keep doing this for a long time. So, it's also helpful to consider, you know, we come together and this is a day of making offerings. But I was reflecting on this and this tradition, this custom, and the role of making offerings and helping to support others. And what came to mind was an exchange between the Buddha and one of his great lay disciples, the very wealthy woman called Visakha, who was a leading citizen of the city of Sarvati in the kingdom of Kosala. And on one occasion, Visakha was extremely wealthy, and also she was very a very nurturing type. She had 20 children of her own, 10 daughters, 10 sons, and each of them had 20 kids. So she was reputedly a grandmother of 400. So she knew about nurturing and caring from a very direct experience. And on one occasion, she went to the Buddha and she asked him for 8 favors. And the Buddha said, "Well, what are these 8 favors that you would like to ask of me?" And she said, "Well, I'd like to have permission that," and I won't go through the whole list and bore you with that. But she said, "If there's a visiting monk arrives from who's traveling, who arrives at the Jetavana at the Prince Jeta's Grove at this monastery. I'd like to be able to provide the things that that monk might need by way of alms food, or if that monk is sick, to provide rice gruel and support for that visiting monk. Or if there are monks who are already here and they're unwell, I'd like to provide medicine. I'd like to provide gruel for the sick also. So for the nuns' community at the nuns' monastery that's up against the walls of the city of Savatthi, the Bhikkhunu Pasayang, where the nuns lived near the Eastern Park, she said, I'd like to be able to provide for them in a similar way. I'd like to provide for the nuns who are sick, or provide bathing cloths when they go to bathe in the river, so they're properly covered up and so on and so forth. So what she wanted to ask for as favors from the Buddha were all ways that she could help the monastic community by way of food, medicine, clothing, and so on and so forth. And so then the Buddha, being the character that he was, didn't just say in a very straightforward way, oh yes, Visakha, of course, that sounds good. He asked her, so Visakha, why do you think, why do you want to make these offerings? You know, what benefit do you see coming from these? And so then she said, well, the benefit I see, if I see a monk arriving, traveling from afar, who's come here to the Jetavana, and I see that a few days later I see that same monk, I will know, oh, well, that monk's newly arrived, therefore he will have received food offerings, he will have received offerings of medicine, he will have received offerings of rice gruel that I provided, that I gave. Or if I see a nun arriving at the nun's monastery, I will, when I see her and I see that she's been around for a little while, I know she's being supported by the offerings that I have made. And when I see that these nuns, these monks, are being helped by the things I've given, that will give rise to gladness in my heart. And when there's that quality of gladness, then that will make it easier for me to be physically relaxed and at ease. That happiness will bring a quality of calm, of relaxation, of delight and ease within myself. And when the body and mind are relaxed and at ease, then it's much more easy to develop concentration. This is a good basis for samadhi. And when when my mind is more able to be concentrated, then this provides a good basis for the arising of insight and wisdom, understanding. And so when there is understanding, then it enables me to see through the obstructions, the defilements that might be there in the mind, and I can let go of the unwholesome and cultivate the wholesome, and to train the heart to abide in purity and in wisdom. And so this will be for my long-lasting welfare and happiness. And then the Buddha's listening to all this, and he says, good, Visakha, very good. and then he allowed her these eight boons, these eight favors. So I feel this is a very useful, significant exchange to reflect upon, because it wasn't that she said, oh, well, I'll make a lot of merit and help me to get reborn in heaven in my next lifetime. I mean, maybe the Buddha would have granted her the eight favors anyway, if she said that. But what was significant in this is that she saw that by making offerings, it wasn't simply that it was going to be helping the monastic community, but also it would bring about wholesome and beautiful qualities within her own mind that would help to support her own spiritual development. So it wasn't just for her own benefit, but that was part of the effect of making those offerings. So for all of you who are gathered here today, and I know Lumpo Pasana was saying earlier how it was really not exactly irritating, but a bit, it was, say, when they kept posting the Katina list on the website, it was sort of confounding, because they kept posting the list and then people kept providing everything on the list. They go, oh, dang, got to come up with a fresh list. And then they'd post a fresh list on the website, and oh, dang, they've given us everything again. Okay, you know, think harder. We need to come up with a fresh list. You know, so that that kind of thoughtfulness and generosity, it certainly is brings things that are of benefit to the monastery. It also it brings the punya, the quality of blessing or merit into the lives of those who give. But it's really important to consider, well, what is punya? What is this quality of blessing? And as in this exchange with the great lay disciple Visakha, Yeah. Punya is not just some kind of celestial bank account where you're kind of racking up the units that kind of trying to keep into the black, yeah, on your celestial bank account, so that when you breathe your last, you'll kind of go up rather than down. Yeah. But it's far more. It's as Visakha recounts, it's that the effect of generosity is something that can be experienced here and now. It's something that can be a great blessing and support for our lives here and now. And so that the understanding of punya or merit in this way is, I think it's important to consider, it's not just saving up for later. It's not just, as one person called it, it's not just fire insurance, you know, to protect you from going down into the lower realms. That kind of fire insurance. But rather, it's a way to bring into being the very qualities in your life that are going to be a great blessing for yourself and a blessing for the people around you. Because, of course, if you are more relaxed and at ease, then you're more of a blessing to the people around you. You're less likely to be cranky or selfish or greedy or anxious, that you're going to be more at ease in yourself. You're going to be easier for others to live with. So the way that you are, the way that you speak, the way that you act becomes not just something that is a blessing for you, but a blessing for everybody in your family, everybody in the workplace, everybody on the highway. Yeah, everyone's happy. Everyone gains from our own, self-development, our own arousing and development of wholesome qualities. So punya, boon, merit, this is not something that's remote or far away. And also, the Buddha in one other discourse, he made the comment that he said, also if maybe you're someone who's a meditator and you think, I haven't got time for all this merit making, you know, I'm into samadhi, I'm only interested in vipassana. Merit is the kind of kindergarten Buddhism, making boon. You know, I want wisdom. You know, vipassana, that's what really matters. And I get the feeling that in the Buddha's time there were people who thought like that, just as there are people who think like that today. That merit making, that's just the kind of beginner class Buddhism. But the real serious, hardcore Buddhist practitioners will be developing insight. But the Buddha said, Don't look down on punya. Don't belittle merit, because punya, merit, is another word for happiness. Punya is another word for happiness, and if we consider it in this way, you can see why that is another word for happiness. Because when we are able to say consider and reflect upon the good things that we have done, it brings that kind of lightness and delight in the heart. There's a quality of Pamoja, it's called delight or a sense of well-being. Also, you can consider Pamoja to be a kind of self-respect. There's a comfort and an enjoyment of just being alive, being present. And then that brings about a relaxation of your body, you're calm, you're at ease, you're free from tension. And then the mind naturally concentrates. It's much easier to pay attention and to rest at ease in the present moment. So if you like to practice meditation, then it's a wonderful and direct support for that. The mind is more easily concentrated. So say, if right now you're happy to be at Abhayagiri, that you like this place, you're happy to be here, you're with all your friends, you've had delicious food to eat, it's the Katina Day, the most sort of delightful and auspicious event of the year. So we're happy to be here. And so that if you're content to be here, then your mind is not racing off thinking about, oh, where I could go afterwards, or where I'd rather be instead. That if you're not thinking about, if you're content where you are, the mind doesn't get restless, creating ideas of where else you might be. So that in a similar way, if the mind is content, if there's a physical ease, then it's much easier to concentrate, to pay attention to the present moment, because the cause for the mind being agitated and wanting to run here, run there, or be somewhere else, that cause is not present. There's nothing to feed the agitation of the mind. So we're able to actually relax and enjoy ourselves. We're not always looking for something to make us feel gratified or happy. So then when the mind pays attention to the present moment, then that there's a natural quality of insight or understanding can arise from that. When the mind is steady and paying attention to the present, then we begin to see and understand, you know, the way that nature works, the way that life works. I was speaking about a Bhayagiri monastery and seeing the development of this place. When I was living here and sort of right in the midst of it, then, you know, the attention gets caught up in all the minor details. And I've been sort of enjoying in a kind of what they call this, there's a wonderful German word which is Schadenfreude, which means delight in the discomfort of others. So it's not quite Schadenfreude. But I have been noticing a very worldly kind of happiness where Lumpur Pasanno and the other monks are talking about having to negotiate with the building department about, you know, what they've got to do with the roadworks in order to get the kutis finaled so they can be proper, they can be legally lived in. And there's this feeling in myself of, I don't have to think about this. I've got plenty to think about at Amravati, don't worry about that. But that feeling of, I don't have to worry about this. I don't have to think about this. This is not my problem. And so that's a very worldly kind of happiness. But still, you know, seeing that coming in and revisiting this monastery as an outsider, not wrapped up in the details, then in a sense you have a chance to feel and appreciate the bigger picture. And just in these last few days being here in that mode where I haven't got my name written as being responsible on any of the activities or projects that are going on. I don't have to train the novices. I don't have to worry about the knee problems of all the anagarikas and monks who are kind of this line of lame monastics. Again, I've got my own supply at Amaravati, lame bhikkhus. And the ones here are not my problem. I don't have to think about them. So coming in and being able to appreciate that is to see how what a tremendous a blessing to a society this is. You know, America is a very wealthy, a very developed country in many, many ways. But one of the things that it lacks, in my humble opinion, my not very humble opinion, is it has a lot of intelligence in the system, but not a lot of wisdom. And there also isn't a very public recognition of the value of goodness. That there's no opportunities, or there isn't many ways that goodness is really celebrated and delighted in. And so coming here and visiting a Bhayagiri monastery, and one of the things that occurred to me is this kind of, it's a sort of goodness factory. This is a monastery is really a sort of kusala development farm. You know, it's like it's a place to plant seeds of wholesomeness, to develop goodness, and for that goodness to grow. And as it says in the scriptures, it provides the opportunity where for sons of good family to go forth from the household life into homelessness, and to really develop the potential that we have as a human being to its fullest extent, that we can. We can come to a place like this and give our body, our mind, our heart to, being here, to enter into the training, whether as a resident or as a short-term visitor, a long-term visitor, as a long-term resident, as a monastic, you know, whatever way we join in. But we plug into that, we in a way plant our seeds in this farm. We entering into this field of punya, this field of merit, and joining in with that effort to cultivate those seeds of goodness. And that is, again, it's a blessing not just for ourselves, but it's also a blessing for America, that there's an opportunity to celebrate goodness, to be in a place where it's okay to be good. In many environments, it's kind of cool to be nasty. Here, it's not cool to be nasty. Yeah, goodness is very cool at the Vayagiri Monastery. And so that being a part of this, just coming for a day today. Maybe you got brought along by a friend. You've never been here before. You don't know anything about Buddhism. But just even at the most, casual contact, just coming in, just dropping in for a first visit on one end of the spectrum, or those of us who've been around for years and years and heavily involved from decades ago, that whether we've been around a long time or a short time, still we can join in with this and participate in this field of merit to, in a sense, cultivate the seeds of wholesomeness, of kusala, of that those potentials that we have as a human being to give rise to those qualities of goodness, to give rise to that which helps to brighten and free the heart and mind and gives rise to wisdom. And then that is not just something that benefits our own lives, our own families, our children, our parents, our loved ones, but also it's an example to the rest of the society. You know, there are many, many people who have heard of places like this existing. You hear off in the hills in Mendocino, you know, there's this bunch of guys walk around in brown sheets, you know, shave their heads, and they keep all these rules. You wouldn't believe the amount of rules these guys have. And that, and just even if you have a very superficial understanding or appreciation, that there's a subtle but very definite effect that has upon the lives of people, to know that places like this exist where a rigorous spiritual life is cultivated and people do their very best to train themselves to go against the current of self-centeredness, the currents of greed, hatred and delusion, in order to develop virtue and concentration, samadhi, and development of wisdom. So that is something to greatly celebrate. So today is a celebration day, but it's not just celebrating the fact that Lumpur Pasana is going to get a new sabong, a new robe, but it's also celebrating the very spirit of the Triple Gem and the capacity that we have as human beings to benefit our own lives and benefit the lives of others. Maybe last thing to share, and in terms of developing wisdom, this is a particular teaching that came up earlier in a conversation with some visitors, friends earlier today, a woman whose husband passed away just a few weeks ago was saying how, you know, she was dealing with a lot of suffering. And her friend said, I remember you some time ago when I last saw you, you know, 3 years ago, you know, you said that suffering is optional. And then this friend of hers said, yeah, at the moment, my suffering is not optional. And so I said, well, you know, that I would say that that it is optional, because it's important in this respect to understand the Buddha's distinction between what is pain, what is a painful feeling, or whether it's a physical sensation or whether it's an emotion on the one hand, and then the anguish or stress or negativity that we create around that. So that one way you can phrase this is saying, yeah, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. And what this means is to say, when you have a body or a mind, we're necessarily going to experience pain, physical pain or mental pain. But it's entirely up to us, I would suggest, and as the Buddha's teaching points to, it's entirely up to us whether we make a problem out of that or not. So you can have a 3-day migraine, you can have a broken leg, physical pain, you can have appendicitis. But even in the depths of great physical pain, in each moment, moment by moment, it's up to us whether we make that into a problem, because that distinction, if we can be clear about that, when then we realize, oh, there's this pain here, but if I'm not resenting it, if I'm not fearing it, if I'm not saying, oh, poor me, it's unfair, you know, how come I always get the 3-day migraine? who gave me this horrible food that gave me this appendicitis? It's somebody else's fault. I can't, you know, sue them. Which the British are less prone to dealing with suffering by a lawsuit, but in America, I noticed when I moved over here, that's the the response to suffering is sue. Find a lawyer. But even suing people doesn't relieve us from that suffering. But what the Buddha pointed to, he said, it's like a warrior on the battlefield. So the ordinary kind of suffering, the physical pain or mental pain, is like being shot by an arrow. So nobody can avoid that. Even an enlightened being is going to experience physical pain or even emotional pain. As the example I was giving this morning to our friend was that when the Buddha's chief disciples, Sariputta and Mahamoggallana, had passed away, he made this very poignant, this very moving comment. He looked out over an assembly like this and said, "It's as if this assembly is empty. The assembly is as if it was empty because Sariputta and Moggallana are not here." So even the Buddha had that feeling for his dear friends, his great companions in the holy life, that they died and they're gone. And so even the Buddha, the great Arahant, the spiritual master above all others, still felt that sense of, oh, my dear companions have passed on. They're not around. They're not going to be seen anymore. And so he felt that sense of grief, but also he knew how not to make a problem out of it. Because his mind was completely awake and completely pure, but he was not insensitive. You know, he felt happiness, he felt unhappiness. So the first arrow, none of us can dodge. We all get hit by the first arrow. But the second arrow, once we appreciate the pain of getting hit by the first one, then that wakes us up, if we're wise, and then we can dodge the second arrow. So as that one comes at us, then we go, oh, I know this. So you get out of the way, and then that second arrow. So that what that means is that even if we have, say, grief for the loss of a loved one, we have regret over some kind of cruel thing that we've said to somebody or some kind of harmful action that we've done, we feel any kind of negative emotion or a painful physical sensation. If we're mindful, then we realize, oh, I can be at peace with this. I can know this experience just as it is and not make a problem out of it. So we're not making ourselves numb. We're not pushing it away. We're not wallowing in it. But we're recognizing, oh, because I bound my life to this other being, now they've passed away, the natural result is to feel pain. I've got a body. This one is now 56 years old, so certainly starting to get a bit creaky. And that I shouldn't make too many smart aleck comments about people with bad knees, just because mine are still good, but I should just be glad that I got good genes from my parents. I feel this in terms of the development of wisdom on a very practical and day-to-day level. This is something that all of us can appreciate. We don't have, and maybe some of you are thinking, "Well, I can't develop wisdom. I never sat still to meditate in my life. That's not my territory. I'll just tambun, you know. I'll just make merit. That wisdom stuff is samadhi. That's way beyond me." Well, I would encourage you not to think that way, because we all have the resources to pay attention to this present moment, and we all have the resources to wake up. And in this simple exercise of learning to recognize the difference between pain, you know, the first arrow and the second arrow, so that when you're experiencing difficulty in your life, physical pain, illnesses, or you know, people in your family that you're arguing with, or maybe you run a restaurant and not all of your staff are very helpful. Yeah, maybe you're having trouble dealing with the officials from the county. That whatever the stress or difficulty might be, if we just remember, oh, it's entirely up to me whether I make a problem out of this or not, then in that moment we can draw upon that banya, that wisdom in our heart, and we can let go. And when we let go, we realize, oh, well, there's still this difficult character on the, you know, in the planning department or the looking after public health is harassing my restaurant. But it's still entirely up to us whether we say dwell in aversion or fear or anxiety and dwelling in the idea it shouldn't be this way, this is bad, it's wrong, and if life was fair, it would be different. And when we notice the mind is doing that, is creating that tension, and then we let go, then we realize, oh, well, there's still that say, difficulty in the family, or there's still that pain in the body, but it is what it is, and we're not fighting against it, we're not creating it as something that's wrong or bad or shouldn't be. And then, in a mysterious way, because we give it a bit more space to it, we're not fighting against it or resenting it, then what we enable ourselves to do is to be able to look after that pain in the body or that illness, or we're able to relate to that difficult person with a bit more sensitivity and a bit more flexibility and ease within ourselves, and we find solutions that come from that more spacious and accommodating attitude. And one of the little aphorisms or sayings that I use a lot, and I've been saying a great deal after I moved to England, was adaptability is the key to happiness. So if you don't remember anything else from today, just to put that in your pocket. Adaptability is the key to happiness. If we're rigid and uptight and we are stuck in our ways, we guarantee that we'll suffer. But if we can be adaptable, if we can make space for each other, we can adapt ourselves to circumstances, then peace and happiness is very possible. So I'm sure I've spoken for long enough now, and you're probably all looking forward to stretching your legs and having a cup of tea or a nice cold drink. So I will release you from your suffering and offer these thoughts for consideration.